Welcome to the Reasons to Believe December 2013 message for monthly partners. I'm Gina Donnelly, your monthly partner representative. And welcome to the last message of 2013 given by Hugh Ross at the Apologetics Conference in Charlotte, North Carolina. His talk is based on his most recent book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Let's listen in.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a different set of apologetics gems, and that is what we see in the book of Job, how the oldest book of the Bible answers today's scientific questions. And you say, how do you know it's the oldest book in the Bible? It's because of the textual clues that you see in the book of Job that argues for a patriarchal date and a Mesopotamian or Northern Arabian locale. Now, in terms of trying to identify the location of this incredible debate between Job and his friends, what we see in the text is that Job lived in the land of Uz. As you can see from the map, Uz lies on the northwestern side of the Persian Gulf. And Eliphaz came from the city of Teman. And the Teman is over there in the country of Edom. Elihi was a Buzite, and we know where Buz is. And the Chaldeans, we're told, carried off Job's camels, and they live in the Mesopotamian plain. And then the many references you see in the book of Job to arid conditions suggest a semi-desert geography. So most scholars are agreed that this is at least the approximate location for this debate between Job and his friends. Now, as far as the timing of the book of Job, there are the following clues. The sacrificial offerings are made by the family head rather than by priests. So this would argue for an Abrahamic era, for example, as opposed to a Mosaic era. Job is the one that's doing the animal sacrifices on behalf of his family, for example. We also notice there are no references in the book of Job to political or economic events. This would argue for an era of city-states as opposed to nations. And also we see no references at all to Hebraic culture. So again, many scholars argue the content of the book of Job predates that of Genesis by 500 or 600 years. Now, another clue is the fact that almost the entire book of Job is written in poetry. And we know that Hebrew didn't exist as a written language until the 15th century BC. So if we're talking 500 or 600 years before that, the only way the book of Job could have been preserved generation from generation is if people memorized it word for word. And what we notice about the Hebrew poetry in the book of Job, it's designed for relatively easy memorization. So I think that's how the book of Job was preserved until it took written form. Now, what about Job's friends? We notice they came from considerably great distances to meet with him. And we also notice that they had reputations of great intellect. Together with Job, they were quite likely the greatest minds of their day. And also, quite likely, the greatest spiritual leaders of their time. And so we see recorded in the book of Job as arguably one of the greatest debates that's ever taken place in human history between Job and his three friends and the young scholar, Elihu. In fact, many think that Elihu is the one that was actually memorizing the conversation between Job and his friends in order that it could be recorded for posterity. Now, if we go to the book of Hosea, we see this statement that my people perish for a lack of knowledge. And as the Bible's first book, Job gives us some of the most important foundational items of knowledge that we need to develop a relationship with God. And you can ask the question, what kind of knowledge did Job focus on? Well, it primarily focuses on apologetics. There's no greater book of apologetics in the 66 books of the Bible than the book of Job. It's one reason I'm speaking on it before you here today. As a pastor and astrophysicist, I can't name a book of the Bible that contains more apologetics content than the book of Job by a wide margin. It contains, for example, the Bible's most extensive descriptions of creation. Not the book of Genesis, it's the book of Job. It contains more than double the content of the material on creation that we see in the entire book of Genesis. And in particular, it expounds at great length on the second origin of life. Now, if you look at Genesis 1, it speaks about three separate origins of life. In creation day 1, the origin of life that is physical. On creation day 5, the origin of life that's not only physical, but also soulish. And finally, the one and only species, creation day 6, that is body, soul, and spirit. Three separate origins of life. And you heard Bill just talk in the last hour about the struggle that evolutionists have with trying to explain the origin of purely physical life. They haven't even tackled the far more challenging problem, how do you explain the origin of soulish creatures? And more significantly, the origin of creatures that are not only physical, but soulish and spiritual. Also, we see in the book of Job, it outlines the salvation message as revealed in the book of nature. What you see in the book of Job is the emphasis on the two books doctrine, that God gave us the book of scripture and the book of nature, and both are the utterly trustworthy, reliable revelations from God to humanity. But what you see in the book of Job is actually a proclamation of the foundational elements of the gospel as revealed through the book of nature. And also we see in the book of Job a remarkable demonstration of the Bible's predictive power. How do we know that the Bible is the authoritative word of God? It's the only book we have that accurately and reliably predicts not only future historical events, but future scientific discoveries. And also, it fills in the major omissions and missing clarifications in the Genesis creation text. Skeptics are very skillful at exposing the book of Genesis as an inadequate description of the account of creation. But what you notice is the big missing holes in the book of Genesis are all filled in by an older book of what we see in the book of Job. Moses didn't have to repeat for the Israelites what they already knew from the book of Job. So it's a great tool for responding to atheist critiques of the book of Genesis. Let me give you a couple of examples. One of the major debates today that's splitting the Church of Jesus Christ and giving cannon fodder to skeptics is that liberal theologians, and for that matter many conservative creationists, actually assert that Genesis declares that the sun, moon, and stars did not exist until creation day 4. They claim that the text is saying that God created the sun, moon, and stars on the fourth creation day. And skeptics are quite good at ridiculing the Bible for such a claim. But does the Bible actually make that kind of claim? Well, Job 37, 38, and 39 parallel the six creation days of Genesis 1. It's not the only biblical text that does that. Psalm 104 does the same thing, as does Proverbs 8. And so what you want to do at a minimum is integrate those four independent texts on the creation story and see how you can consistently weave them together. And what you notice in Job 38, for example, is when it's addressing the condition of planet Earth before the first creation day, God speaks and says, "I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness." And the "it" there refers to the waters that covered the whole surface of the earth. Now go back to Genesis 1. Genesis 1, 2, water covers the entire surface of the earth. But Genesis 1, 2 also says there was darkness on the face of the deep. It was dark over the surface of the waters. But what Job 38 clarifies for us, it's dark not because of the lack of light, not because of the lack of the sun, moon, and stars. It's dark because God had enveloped the primordial earth in a cloud layer that would not let the light pass through. It was made dark by the clouds, not by the lack of the sun, moon, and stars. Then you go back to Genesis chapter 1, and what does it say about creation day 1? It doesn't say that God created the light. It says, "Let the light be." This is when God transforms the atmosphere from opaque to translucent, where light can now pass through and photosynthesis can begin. The origin of life is at the beginning of creation day 1. And what happens on creation day 4? It says, "Let there be the great lights." Notice it doesn't say that God is creating the great lights. It says, "Let the great lights be." Why? So they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. For whose benefit? What you notice in Genesis 1, all the life that God describes before day 4 doesn't need to know where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky. But every life form that God describes his creating on creation days 5 and 6 absolutely needs to know where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky in order to reproduce at the right time of the year, migrate at the right time of the year, and hibernate at the right time of the year. And so here we see in just one sentence of Job 38 how it reconciles a major controversy within the church and a major cause of ridicule as the Bible, as the inerrant Word of God. Let me give you another example. Liberal scholars will insist that the Bible is filled with provable errors, since the Babylonian equivalent for the expanse in Genesis 1, referring to creation day 2, is a brass dome where rain and starlight pass through its holes. And you've probably seen this diagram of what the ancient Sumerians and Babylonians believed about the sky above us. Again, Job comes to the rescue here. And what you see in Job 37, almost the entire chapter of Job 37 deals with the events of creation day 2. God establishing a stable water cycle with water in the expanse above, referring to the troposphere, and water in the oceans below, actually describes God setting up the water cycle so that we have three different kinds of liquid precipitation and three different kinds of frozen precipitation. But towards the end of Job 37, we sign this statement: can you join him, namely God, in spreading out the skies hard as a mirror of cast bronze? And again, these liberal scholars have looked at that one verse and say, isn't the Bible there declaring that the sky above us is this bronze dome? But they don't read on. If you read on to Job 37:21, it says, now no one can look at the sun, bright as it is in the skies, after the wind has swept them clean. Notice it's using a metaphor here. And what you may need to recognize is, if you take yourself back to the biblical era, the best mirror that existed in that technology was hardened brass that was polished to a high degree, and polished to such a high degree that you could not look at a light that was reflected in that bronze mirror. And this is kind of the image it's telling us, that when a rainstorm comes and it clears all the dust out of the sky, all the smog out of the sky, and yes, there was smog even back thousands of years ago, you get that from trees, and when all that's cleared of the atmosphere and the sun comes out and the clouds break, there's no way you can look up at the sky. It's way too bright. You'll hurt your eyes. It's just like looking at a light that's reflected back to you in one of these polished bronze mirrors. And what we notice is the book of Job defines several metaphors that are used by later books that are given to us in the Bible. Now, Job 37 to 39, as I mentioned already, it parallels the six creation days of Genesis, but it also gives us detailed instructions on how to fulfill the Genesis 1, 28 to 30 command. Notice what you get in Genesis 1. God tells Adam and Eve, I'm putting you in charge of planet Earth. You're to manage its resources for the benefit of all life, but never tells them how to do it. And people have been mystified by that. But if Job is truly the oldest book in the Bible, no problem. You go back to these three chapters and you get a detailed creation care manual on how to fulfill the command of Genesis 1, 28 to 30. Now, what I do in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, is give several examples of how Job 37, 38, and 39 not only give a detailed creation care manual for the ancients, it's for us today. So what is one of the major controversies facing modern society? Global warming. Everybody's talking about global warming and trying to figure out what to do about it. Now, there's no question that the ice in Canada is melting, the polar ice cap is melting, we are experiencing global warming. The big debate is, who's responsible for that global warming? Is it natural process, or is it human input, or is it a combination of the two? Well, in one sense, I'm arguing it doesn't matter. There are good things that we can do to respond to this situation that will economically benefit the entire planet, all life and humans included, and at the same time do the best thing to keep the planet in the condition that God gave it to us. Basically, that's what God was telling Adam and Eve. I gave you this great planet with all of its resources. Don't mess it up. Maintain it in the condition I gave it to you. Well, let me give you one example from Job 37 and 38. makes the message, and we just see this all through Job 37 especially, the most important thing we need to do to manage the planet for the benefit of all life is to make sure we maintain this incredibly designed precipitation pattern. You know, three different kinds of frozen precipitation, three different kinds of liquid precipitation. Well, one of the things we've noticed that we humans have done that's probably been the greatest abuse of planet Earth is that we've converted large tracts of our planet into rainless deserts. So, for example, today the Sahara Desert is 10 times bigger than it was in the days of the Roman Empire. The Gobi Desert is 4 times bigger. The Gobi Desert is now invading the very suburbs of Beijing, China. And if we were to reverse the damage we did to the rainfall patterns in just these two regions, that region would help mitigate to a large extent global warming and grow the world economy. You've got 3 million square miles of the Sahara Desert that's producing food for nobody. Now you say, can we really replant the Sahara Desert? Well, one of the proposals I make in my book is we could give the sub-Saharan peoples all the petroleum they want free of charge on the condition that they work with us to replant the Sahara Desert. So instead of stripping it of vegetation, they work with us to replant it. Can this actually be done? Well, the Israelis have demonstrated it will work. The Israelis have shown us how you can take a desert with only 4 inches of rain and in a matter of one generation, double the rainfall. What do? You plant grass and trees at a certain distance. You work the soil so that the water will flow down to the roots of these plants that are well separated. Now these plants transpire water vapor to the atmosphere. That increases the rainfall, which means you can increase the density of plants. And eventually, where you had a former desert, you actually have a forest. It can be done. Now, maybe with a Sahara Desert, it would take two generations. But literally, we could reverse 2,000 years of damage. Now, what would that do? Well, in the days of the Roman Empire, what we now call the Sahara Desert was the breadbasket for the Roman Empire. That's where the grain came to feed 200 million people. Now it's feeding nobody. Africa is facing a food crisis. We could reverse that food crisis, provide an economic source of well-being for those people, and at the same time, all that vegetation would soak up huge quantities of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Now, if you pick up my book, I also show you how if we begin to manage whales and ostriches in the way that God intended, that would also have a dramatic impact on bringing more economic well-being to the planet, actually increase the gross national product of the planet, and at the same time be a huge factor in resolving the global warming situation that we're currently facing. What's the lesson here? God has designed his creation in such a way that we humans face problems in fulfilling the command of Genesis 1, and advance these provided solutions that are optimally ethical and at the same time optimally economic. See, this takes the politics out. You know, you got the conservatives out there saying we have to do what's economically beneficial. You got the liberals out there saying we must do what is ethical. I'm saying we can do both at the same time, and everybody can agree and vote on this, and everybody will be happy. That's the message of the book of Job. And we give you several examples of how that can work out in fulfilling the Genesis 1 command. Now, what I find incredible about these chapters in Job 38 and 39 is that they're loaded with questions. I count about 60 questions that God poses to Job and his friends in Job 38 and 39. Now, they're basically science questions, and they're rather fundamental science questions. But here we are 4,000 years later, and of those 60 questions, we can only answer 11. There's still 49 to go. So we haven't really advanced that far in terms of our study of the book of nature. So I suggest that maybe that would be a good guide for the National Science Science Foundation for what to fund and encourage. But what's interesting is those 11 questions we have been able to answer, every single one has delivered a powerful new apologetic tool to the body of Christ. So you can give us an example. Well, let me give you one that comes from just the past 2 years. What do you see in Job 38, 19, and 20? Where does darkness reside? Can you take it to its places? Do you know the paths to its dwellings? I remember reading this at age 17 and being stunned because what I was being taught in my physics and astronomy classes is that darkness was simply the absence of light. What I saw here in the book of Job was that darkness is an actual substance. It's a substance that has specific geographical locations within the universe. Now, of course, back then, we had no idea whether or not darkness was a substance, let alone how much of it there was or where it resides. But thanks to discoveries made in the last 10 years, and especially in the last 3 years, we now know that the Bible got it right, that darkness is an actual substance, that it has specific quantities that are designed to make human life possible, and specific geographical locations that are highly fine-tuned to make our existence possible. So, for example, we now know that the stuff that emanates light in the universe, that's only 0.25% of all the stuff of the universe. The universe is primarily made up of dark stuff. Here's an inventory. Dark energy makes up 72.1% of all the stuff of the universe. Exotic dark matter, this is matter that doesn't interact with photons like neutrinos and axions, that makes up 23.3%. The protons, neutrons, and electrons, what we call ordinary dark matter, 4.35%. So the stuff you're made up of is rather a minor component of the universe. And then the stars and the stellar remnants of stars, that's 0.27%. And if you're talking planets, that's one part in a million of all the stuff of the universe. So it's kind of humbling to realize how little we make up of the total content of the universe. Now, we've known about these percentages for at least a few years. What we now know, however, is if you were to ask me as a scientist, what is the most spectacular evidence that you could give me for supernatural, superintelligent design? It would be the fine-tuning in the quantity of dark energy. Want me to ask you for second place? The fine-tuning in the quantity of exotic dark matter. Third place? The fine-tuning in the quantity of ordinary dark matter. Say, what kind of fine-tuning you're talking about? Well, for dark energy, change it by as little as 1 part in 10 to the 122nd power, and you have no possibility for life anytime, anywhere in the universe. It ranks by a factor of a quadrillion, 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 quadrillion times as the most spectacular evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design. So in terms of arguing for intelligent design, really the first place to start is astronomy, and then go to physics. The intelligent design debate was won more than 25 years ago in the discipline of astrophysics. But let me tell you what's brand new. What's brand new is we now know where all this dark stuff resides. We know that the dark energy resides on the cosmic surface and is evenly distributed over the whole surface of the universe. The universe, by the way, is kind of like planet Earth. Earth is three dimensions. We humans reside in the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. All the stars and galaxies, and for that matter, all the space-time dimensionality, is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe, ignoring for a moment the six tiny space dimensions that accompany length, width, and height. So that's where the dark energy resides. What about the exotic dark matter? It resides in gigantic halos around galaxies and galaxy clusters. And ordinary dark matter resides in close-in halos around galaxies. So if you look at our Milky Way galaxy, for example, 120,000 light years across, that would be the stars and the planets and the gas that make up our galaxy. But beyond that is a halo of ordinary dark matter that's about 10 times bigger. And beyond that, there's a halo of exotic dark matter that's about 10 times bigger than the halo of ordinary dark matter. But it takes these specific locations of the dark energy, the exotic dark matter, and the ordinary dark matter in order to have highly fine-tuned locations so that advanced life is possible. For example, if we don't have these halos exactly situated the way they are, you cannot have a galaxy like our Milky Way galaxy that's a spiral galaxy with highly symmetrical spiral arms where the arms are separated at just the right rate with just the right mass in those spiral arms so that life, advanced life, is possible in our spiral galaxy. So yeah, when you celebrate Thanksgiving next month, you want to thank God for how we fine-tune the locations of the exotic dark matter, the ordinary dark matter, and the dark energy. At least that's what we do in our family. the point is, Job said it first, 4,000 years before any astronomer discovered this. Now, Job 12:7, as I mentioned earlier, Job gives the most extensive account on the second origin of life. And it begins in Job chapter 12, where he says, "Ask the beasts." And that's a reference to the large land mammals. "Ask the beasts and they will teach you, or the birds of the air and they will tell you." Now, when Genesis refers to the soulish animals, it's referring to those animals that God endows with mind, will, and emotions, so that they are motivated to care for their young, to nurture their young, and relate to one another, but at the same time, God designs them to be motivated to relate to human beings and to serve and please us human beings in specific ways. So we put a much higher value, say, on the birds and the mammals and the higher reptiles that fall into that category of caring for their young and being tameable by human beings so that they can serve and please us. Now, what I've noticed when I've debated atheists around the world, they live in cities. I've yet to meet an atheist in a rural setting. In a rural setting, people have contact with these animals. And just like Job says, they teach us, they instruct us. But when you're cut off from the teaching and the instruction of these higher animals, you miss something. And what I'm going to do in the next few minutes is show you how God designed these animals to teach us important lessons about ourselves and also about God himself and how we can reach out and form a relationship with God. But I think it's no accident that atheism is an urban phenomenon. And because more people live in cities, we have more atheists. Well, let's begin with Charles Darwin. He was an urbanite, and what he wrote in Descent of Man in 1871, he said, "The differences between human and non-human minds is simply one of degree and not of kind." So he was the first biologist to seriously propose that we humans are no different than the animals. We only differ by our degree of intellect. There's nothing really distinct about the human mind. And as proof for this, he pointed out in a letter that he wrote to a colleague, there is a much wider interval in mental power between one of the lowest fishes and one of the higher apes than between an ape and a man. Well, from a biblical context, I would be forced to agree with him. Because from a biblical context, the fish doesn't have a mind at all. It's not part of the nephesh. Whereas an ape has a mind, and we have a mind. So, of course, there's going to be a bigger difference between a fish and an ape and a mind if all you're doing is looking at, say, the intellectual capability of the brain of the ape, the fish, and the human being. And it's been remarkable to me. This was written, 140 years ago. And only now are scientists beginning to test Charles Darwin's claims about the evolution of the human mind. And it begins in a paper titled, "Can Evolution Explain How Minds Work?" This paper was published just 3 years ago. And the introduction to the paper, the two authors write, "Like Darwin, biologists have tended to assume that species with shared physical ancestry will have similar cognitive abilities." So they would point, for example, to the chimpanzee and say, look how remarkably similar the chimpanzee's body is to a human body. And therefore, the mind of the chimpanzee would be the one that's most similar to a human mind. Well, then they go on in their paper to report some studies that they've done on researches with birds and wound up concluding that ravens far surpass chimpanzees in intellectual capability, and point out that no biologist is going to seriously argue that our most recent common ancestor is a raven as opposed to some other creature. So he says this is a huge discontinuity for any kind of naturalistic evolutionary model. And they're right. Ravens really do far surpass. My own father had a pet raven when he was growing up. And what he noticed is that raven could pick any lock that he built for the cage of the raven. In fact, he would purposely redesign the lock, put the raven inside, and then watch the raven use tools to pick the lock and get out of the cage. And also, my dad would make these three-dimensional puzzles like we buy for children, the little ball inside, and he'd put it inside the cage and watch the raven solve the puzzle and get the food treat out or the ball out or whatever. But he also noticed something else. the raven performed at its highest capability when it was being observed by a human being. In other words, God designed ravens to entertain us human beings with their intellectual capability, and they loved to show off. And when they got an audience, they far outperform what they do if no human being is watching. Making the point that God really did design these birds to relate to us human beings, to serve us and to please us. Now, there's an even greater discontinuity that's being pointed out with this line of research, and by the way, it's primarily going on at UC San Diego and UCLA. And in a separate paper with the interesting title, Darwin's Mistake. It's the first time I've seen a paper in the scientific literature with that title, Darwin's Mistake. Three UCLA neuroscientists establish a far bigger discontinuity than the one between the chimpanzee and human beings. And they write in their paper, quote, "There's a significant discontinuity in the degree to which human and non-human animals are able to approximate the higher order systematic relational capabilities of a physical symbol system." I mean, you've got to write that way to get published in the scientific literature. But the point they're making is that no non-human animal can appreciate the meaning, the beauty, and the elegance of, say, the Higgs field equations. And just so you can see the elegance and the beauty, here are some of those Higgs field equations responsible for the discovery of the Higgs boson. But the truth of the matter is, no non-human animal can even read the first page of the first Fun with Dick and Jane reader that those of us who are older were exposed to as we went into grade one. And for that matter, no non-human animal is even capable of understanding or responding to any of these basic symbols. And so the three authors, Penn et al., conclude, "We show that the symbol-relational discontinuity pervades nearly every domain of cognition." Darwin was wrong. We don't simply differ by degree. We differ by kind with respect to all other animals here on planet Earth. Now, something else you see in the book of Job. As these animals were created to serve and please us, so we were created to serve and please God. And I already gave you the example of how God designed the raven to please us with its intellectual capabilities and to relate to us. But now there's a new database we can tap into for scientific research. It's called YouTube. And at the University of San Diego, they actually employed a team of graduate students to spend thousands of hours watching video clips on YouTube. But what the professor said, we want you to watch video clips of animal behavior. And probably the most famous animal in all of the research is this little character, a cockatoo by the name of Snowball. And many of you may have seen this on YouTube. And what I'm going to just show you is a one-minute video clip of what this bird can do. Now, I'll give you a little bit of background. This was a bird that was owned by a teenage girl. And the teenage girl was really into the Backstreet Boys. And her favorite song of the Backstreet Boys was Everybody. And so this bird kind of picked up on that. The bird was strongly bonded to this teenage girl and therefore began to adopt the enjoyment that this girl had of the Backstreet Boys. And so here's Snowball in action. As you can see, he even knows how to congratulate himself. But the whole point is, birds only behave that way when they have a strong emotional bond with a human being. It's not that cockatoos seem to favor the Backstreet Boys, as what happens is, when a cockatoo gets strongly bonded to a human being, they will favor the favorite music of the human being to whom they're bonded to. And that's the phenomena we're seeing here. Now, this research team for UCLA didn't believe this when they saw this on YouTube. They said, somebody trained the bird to kind of do those steps. It's got nothing to do with the music. But when they went to where Snowball lived, they actually took that music of the Backstreet Boys, speeded it up, slowed it down, and what they discovered is no matter what speed they ran the music at, Snowball would keep perfect beat to the music in terms of the dance routine. And so this led them to conclude, there really is something to the fact that the bonding with a human being is having an impact. They also pointed out that when they went out into the wild, actually parrots have their own music. So for example, when parrots are mating, they will develop a song. But what they've noticed is that in the wild, parrots haven't been shown to dance to a beat, even to the songs for their courtship displays. So you think that a male parrot that is bonded to a female parrot would actually demonstrate this dancing capability. But it only happens when they're bonded to human beings. So it shows that these creatures do things with us that they don't do with one another. And by the way, this isn't unique to parrots and cockatoos. We've even seen it in elephants. Elephants will dance to our music and our sounds, but only if they're bonded to a human being. Now, this was published 3 years ago. I should have published this some 45 years ago, because I had this pet parrot by the name of Pedro. And Pedro was bonded to me of all the members of the family, and he loved to sit on my shoulder. But he quickly figured out I didn't like him making nasty spots on my clothing. And so he actually potty trained himself. I didn't train him. What he'd do is he figured I didn't like it, so he would actually do a little tug on my earlobe every time he had to go. I would put him on one of his trees. He would go and hop back on my shoulder. I never had a dirty shirt from that point forward. Now, the other thing he would do is when I would get up in the morning, he would hop on my shoulder and check my face to see if I missed any spots when I was shaving. And he would clip off the whiskers that I had not quite... And after I was finished with one of my meals, he'd like to go inside my mouth and clean my teeth. I mean, and again, you can see the degree to which these creatures are capable of trusting us. But the most annoying part about this bird with respect to my parents is my parents loved to play bridge. And so they would recruit me and my grandfather to play bridge with him. And Pedro would sit on my shoulder as we were playing bridge. But that Pedro would watch my grandfather. And he figured out every time I won a bridge hand. And every time I won a bridge hand, he would do a little dance on my shoulder, and he would cheer and flap his feathers. And I remember my mother saying, it's bad enough to lose to her son at bridge, but his bird gloats. So my mother also said, you know, Hugh, your bird is a music snob, because whenever he heard the Brandenburg concertos being played, he would sway to the music and dance and clearly enjoyed it to a high degree. But when my sisters played their brand of rock music, he would squawk to such a loud, raucous degree that they'd be forced to turn their music off. Now, it's not that he hated rock music and loved the Brandenburg concertos. It was he was bonded to me and not to my sisters. That's what's really what's going on. And so we see in the book of Job, and especially Job 38 and 39, it expands on the Genesis 1 message that God created these soulish animals to serve and please us, each in a different way. Remember what God said to Adam? I want you to spend time relating to these higher animals and give each of them an appropriate name that expresses how they distinctly relate to you and serve and please you, each in a different way. And literally every species of bird, mammals, and the higher reptiles relate to us in a different way and serve and please us in a different way. But what you also see specifically in Job 38 and 39, it shows you how crucial certain soulish animals are for the launch of human civilization. You've probably heard of David Letterman's top 10 list. There's a top 10 list in Job 38 and 39. It names the 10 most important bird and mammal species for the launch and maintenance of human civilization. And I write about this in my book, making the point that they're designed in two different ways to serve and please us human beings at the beginning of the launch of human civilization, and in a completely different way, a radically different way, towards the end of human civilization, depending on your eschatology, but basically very different in the 21st century than what we see at the launch of human civilization. So what are these top 10 animals? Well, beginning towards the end of Job 38, the text mentions the lion, the raven, the goat, the deer, the donkey, the ox, the ostrich, the horse, the hawk, and the eagle. And what I do in my book is show you where each of these 10 animals was critical for serving and pleasing human beings when human civilization first began, and how very differently these creatures do it in the modern era. Two completely different ways. Now, I haven't got time this afternoon to take you through all 10. I do that in a separate one-hour talk. But let me pull out just two of these creatures. I picked two, the horse and the donkey, because the horse and the donkey are often given evidence for the evolutionary paradigm, but Job tells us it's the exact opposite. And the problem is evolutionists look at the horse and the donkey in terms of their physical features, but they ignore their soulish features. And so if you look at the donkey, for example, it looks kind of like a smallish horse in terms of its physical features. There's not much difference between the two. And evolutionists have pointed out you can actually take a female donkey and mate it with a male horse, and you'll get a mule. Now, the mule will not reproduce after its own kind, but they're physically similar enough to one another that they can be cross-mated. Now, this is not denied in the Bible. The Levitical law, it tells us that it's possible to take two different kinds of animals and mate them and get an offspring. But there's also a command there, don't do it. It's not saying it can't be done. It says we shouldn't do it. Because not so much of what you get physically, but what happens to the soulishness when you take, say, a donkey and a horse. Because they got two very different soulish features. And when you bring them together to get a mule, you get soulish problems. Now, there's physical features that certain people like about the mule, but there are soulish consequences. Now, when you look at the donkey, in terms of the way it relates to human beings, it has a feature, and this is described in the book of Job, how it says, if you lose your donkey, don't worry about it. A donkey is designed by God to be able to switch from domestication to living in the wild very easily. And when you find your wild donkey, it's been domesticated, it's gone back to the wild. 3 months later, you notice that the donkey is taking very good care of itself in the wild environment, but you can go up to that donkey and it can be re-domesticated. Now, for example, with a horse, if you lose your horse and it kind of goes back into the wild, typically it won't make it. And the rare situations where the horse is able to adapt to a wild living, you're not going to re-domesticate it. But with a donkey, you can go from domestication to wild living to domestication, back to wild living. You can do this with a donkey. Now, in terms of how the donkey relates to us as a human being, it's incredibly wary of danger. The donkey is highly motivated to keep its human owner out of risk and out of danger. And you kind of see this in the book of Numbers with Balaam, how his donkey was trying to keep him safe. Well, that's true of every donkey that is bonded to a human being. They're highly motivated to keep you away from danger, which is why they use donkeys, for example, in taking people down the Grand Canyon. I mean, that's kind of a very risky venture, but if you're riding on a donkey, it will make sure that you riding on the donkey are not going to fall down into the Grand Canyon. Or if there's a rattlesnake ahead of the path, it's going to stop and keep you safe from being attacked by that snake. It does everything it can to avoid risk for its human owner, which is why donkeys are a terrible animal to take into battle. People don't use donkeys to ride into battle. Because as soon as that donkey sees arrows coming its way, it's going to head in the opposite direction. That's where you're going to want to use a horse. A horse loves adventure. It's the one animal that will actually take you into very high-risk situations. It's the exact opposite of the donkey in that respect. So it doesn't matter how many cannon shells are exploding around it, or bullets are flying by, spears or arrows, it will take you where you want to go, regardless of whatever risk might come to you or to the animal itself. And it's the ideal transportation animal. You know, I'm 5'11". If I were to get on a donkey, my feet would drag on the ground. Now, you could say, well, how about a camel? Well, when you ride on a camel, you're so far up off the ground, and it's kind of got this hump thing. It's kind of hard to stay on the back of a camel. And if you fall, you'll probably do yourself serious damage. But the horse is really ideal. Your feet aren't going to drag on the ground. It provides you with a nice seat in which you can ride. And you're not so high off the ground that if for some reason you were to slip off, you're going to do yourself serious injury. And it's also, just like us human beings, capable of efficient perspiration. You know, we're kind of the two animals on the planet that can do that. And so what that means is the horse can go wherever we want to go. And like us, it's totally clothing tolerant. I mean, my cats aren't. There's no way I'm going to put clothes on my cats. And, you know, we are actually designing dogs to be clothing tolerant. But notice it took us thousands of years of dog breeding to make our dogs clothing tolerant. But the horse has always been clothing tolerant, which means if we're going to go into a cold place, we put clothes on ourselves and we put clothes on our horse. And if we're going into a warm place, we make sure that the horse has got as much water as it needs, just like we drink lots of water, so we can perspire efficiently and keep ourselves cool. Therefore, the horse has really been the ideal transportation animal. But the thing that's really special about the horse is its incredible loyalty to its human owner. It will do anything to serve its human owner, including risk its own health. And so, for example, you can race a horse at such a high velocity for such a high period of time that the horse gets a heart attack and dies. It will do that if you ask the horse to do it. It will literally sacrifice its life to do your bidding. A donkey won't, but a horse will. And so from an evolutionary perspective, it's one thing to say that the horse and the donkey must have a recent common ancestor by natural descent, but how do you explain the radical differences in its soulish features, how different the mind of a horse is from the mind of a human being? Given the incredible differences in the way they relate to us in such distinct ways, both must be specially created by the Creator God of the Bible. Now, in terms of this top 10 list, what you'll see in the book is we actually look at those places on planet Earth where humans began to come in. I mean, kind of the message of Genesis chapter 10 is human beings began in the Persian Gulf area, and then God scattered them over the face of the earth. But as they were scattered over the face of the earth, they behaved with respect to the soulish animals in different ways. So, for example, when humans invaded Australia, within a short period of time, they drove to extinction 86% of the large-bodied bird and mammal species. And notice, thereafter, the Aborigines were never able to get themselves out of the Stone Age. They couldn't launch civilization because they lacked the very animals that the Book of Job tells us are essential for the launch of human civilization. Same thing happened in North and South America. When people invaded North America, they drove to extinction 73% of the large-bodied bird and mammal species. And likewise, in South America, it was 79%. And in both continents, the indigenous peoples there were not able to launch themselves out of a Stone Age culture. That was limited to Europe, where the extinction rate was only 65%. And to Africa and Asia, where the extinction rate was far less. In fact, sub-Saharan Africa, it was only 4.5% of extinction. Now, here's the difference. People often ask me, you know, why did God create so many bipedal primate species before human beings? Well, if you look at those species, each successive one was a little bit better at hunting large-bodied bird and mammal species than the previous one. And I believe that God created those separate species in order to give the large-bodied bird and mammal species living with them an opportunity to step-by-step adapt to the coming future shock of the super predator, namely us, Homo sapiens sapiens. And I think as evidence for that, North America, South America, and Australia, we see no fossil evidence of bipedal primates before human beings. But we see lots of evidence in Europe, Asia, and Africa. Notice in those three continents, the large-bodied bird and mammal species survived to a sufficient degree that humans were able to launch civilization. But it didn't happen in North America, South America, and Australia. Now, another lesson. As it takes a higher being to tame the soulish animals, so also it takes a higher being to tame human beings. As you go into Job 40, 41, and 42, God makes a point to Job and his friends. You've been able to tame all manner of these soulish animals, even animals that are extraordinarily difficult to tame. And the message of the book of Job is some are more difficult to tame than others. You actually see that in Genesis 1, where it talks about the long-legged land mammals that are easy to tame, and those contrasts that are difficult to tame. And a generality is this: the herbivores are easy to tame, the carnivores are difficult to tame. But there's actually one herbivore species that's extremely difficult to tame, and one carnivore species that's even more difficult to tame, and this is the reference to the leviathan and the behemoth. And as you read that text carefully, and especially check the more ancient commentaries, it's clear that the leviathan is a reference to the crocodile and the behemoth to a hippopotamus. You can tame a hippopotamus, but you're going to have to take it from its mother from the time it was born, separate it from its mother, and then work with that hippopotamus on a daily basis. And when it grows up, it will be bonded to you and serve and please you and do your bidding. With a crocodile, it's even more difficult. You've got to be able to take it from the time it hatches out of its egg and daily handle and work with that crocodile at least 1 hour a day all of its life before it will do its bidding and be tamed. And if you miss a day, you're in trouble. And what you see in the book of Job, it tells you what happens when your taming capacity is a little more limited. The creature will turn on you. Well, it makes the point that we humans have successfully tamed all the nephesh creatures, even the leviathan and even the behemoth. But there's one nephesh creature we can't tame, and that's ourselves. Only God can bring humility to a proud human being. And the lesson here is, as sin damages our relationship with soulish animals, so also it destroys our relationship with God. These soulish animals were designed to serve and please us to a far greater degree than what we witness today. God designed them to come to us and serve and please us. Instead, they typically run away from us out of fear that we're going to do them harm. So I relate in the book my experience as a Canadian going into the wild parts of British Columbia, where I was told by park rangers that human beings hadn't been in over 50 years. Because I wanted to see for myself how these animals behave where the sin factor is not present. And indeed, I observed that when I would set up my tent, they would come and observe, kind of circle around the tent and watch and try to figure out who I was. But by the next day, I was able to touch them. They really wanted to have that contact with me and to serve and please me each in their specific ways. But it's sin that causes these creatures to run away from us. Likewise, it's sin that causes us as human beings to run away from God instead of expressing our created motivation to seek after God and to come to Him and serve and please Him. So this is kind of the basis of my point, that God uses these lower animals, the birds, mammals, and the higher reptiles, as an object lesson. He says, as they are designed to serve a higher being, so you are designed to serve a higher being. As sin causes a problem in your relationships with them, it also causes a problem in your relationship with me. As it takes a higher being to tame these animals, likewise it takes a higher being to tame you. At the end of the book of Job, God makes his point, speaking to Job and his friends. Do you have an arm like God's? Then look at all who are proud and bring them low and humble them. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. But all of us realize we can't do it. Only God can do that. And the book of Job closes with a promise that God will give humility to any who come to him and sincerely ask for it. And we do that, then we receive the grace that leads unto salvation. So that's kind of the heart of my point, that the record of nature itself and these animals kind of point the way to salvation that the rest of the 65 books of the Bible detail out specifically. Hey, if you want to read more about this, you can get my latest book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. You know, people sometimes are a little bit intimidated because I'm an astrophysicist, but I'm also a pastor, and I want to tell you this. Reasons to Believe actually has more editors than we have scholars, and our editorial team is called the Translation Department. They translate what our scholars write into material that can be read by anybody. I think that's particularly true of Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. The feedback I've gotten is it's an extremely readable book that really opens eyes to people of how his creation is designed to bring us to him. I'd also recommend this book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, which gives you the big picture in creation and how the universe was designed to bring about the end of all evil, And this book summarizes the testable creation model that we've laid out in some detail in 8 other books. And with that, I think I'm down to just 2 minutes of Q&A, or maybe I'm all out. Well, how much time do I have left?
You can take a minute. Dr. Ross, you want to take a
question? Okay, I can take a couple of questions, and then I'll be at our book table out there to field more questions. Yes. Have I ever thought about running for president? Well, there's actually a law in this country that you have to be born in the U.S. in order to run for president. I was born in Canada, not the United States. And you know what? I've got a more important mission. My primary citizenship is in heaven. I don't want to waste my time with politics. And that's why I made that statement about global warming. If we take the advice of the book of Job, we can take it out of the political arena and really make it a message that will bring service and economic well-being and an ethical response from all human beings. So that's my goal, my passion.
He does look a little bit like Clint Eastwood, though, don't you think?
He's got more hair.
Last question.
I know I asked you this yesterday, but I can't remember a lot of what you said. It's kind of fuzzy. You know, the word for day in Genesis 1, the Hebrew word yom, can
right.
mean a long period of time. But if that's the definition that we're supposed to take, then why is it that the English translators wrote it as day instead of one of our words for a long period of time, like
right.
era, epoch, eon, gotcha. Age.
Okay, I think you all heard his question. I mean, I take the position that the correct interpretation of Yom in Genesis 1 is that God created in 6 long periods of time. Now, the word Yom in Hebrew has 4 different literal definitions. It can mean part of the daylight hours, like, say, from noon to 2 p.m. It can mean all of the daylight hours. It can mean a 24-hour period or a long but finite period of time. But the question he's asking is, if God really intended this to be interpreted as 6 long periods of time, why didn't the translators actually interpret it that way? Well, as I was describing yesterday to this young man, this is basically an English language controversy. This whole idea, is it young or old earth? And I think the reason for that is biblical Hebrew has an incredibly small vocabulary. 3,000 words if you don't count the proper names, names of cities and people. English, by contrast, is the largest vocabulary language ever developed, 4 million words. And so in English, we have over a dozen words for a long period of time. But in biblical Hebrew, the only word you got is the word yom. Now, in modern Hebrew, they got yom and olam. But in biblical Hebrew, olam could only be used for once upon a time or a long time ago. It could never be used for an epoch of time. So the only way Moses could communicate 6 long periods of time is to use the word yom. But then his question is, why don't the interpreters do that? Well, the interpreters or in translators do appreciate they're working with a tiny vocabulary language and forced to translate it into a large vocabulary languages. So in order to be as non-committal to the text as possible, they purposely use words of translation that leave it up to the human interpreter to do what the Hebrews had to do, which is basically look at this word yom, look at it in the context, contrast it with other biblical creation texts, like Psalm 104 and Job 38 and 39, and then choose which of the 4 literal definitions to use. Now, notice that our English word day can mean 24 hours. It can also mean the daylight hours, and it can mean a long period of time, like the day of President Reagan or the day of the dinosaurs. And so that's why translators have chosen to interpret it as day as opposed to epoch, because it's the closest to the ambiguity we see in the original language where it's got multiple definitions. Where if we were to translate it as epoch, there's only one way to look at that. Whereas the English word day, there's multiple ways to look at it, and that's actually what you see in the original text. But the reason why I take it as six long periods of time is that it tells us in the text that there's no evening and morning for day seven, which means we're still in the seventh day. And notice that's the day when God rests. And when I read that for the first time at age 17, it answered the fossil record enigma, how we see a very aggressive speciation before human beings, but virtually none afterwards. For 6 days God created, on the seventh day rests. The reason why the majority of scientists say we see no scientific evidence for the handiwork of God, the vast majority of scientists restrict their research to day seven. If all you're doing is studying the seventh day, you will not see the miraculous evidence for God's handiwork. It explains why the majority of us astronomers believe in a God and an afterlife, because our data comes from the past. We're looking at the 6 days, and we see the handiwork of God everywhere. So it explains why more chemists, physicists, and astronomers believe in God than biologists do. And let me tell you this. There's only 10,000 research astronomers in the whole world. There's 3 million research biologists. So it's not surprising that the majority of scientists say we see no evidence for the handiwork of God. They're biologists predominantly, and they're all predominantly working on day seven, not the 6 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ross.
Thank you for listening in this month with Hugh, and thank you for listening all year long. It is your faithful support which allows us to research, create, and disseminate RTV's hopeful message of integrating science and faith. From all of us here at Reasons to Believe, may the Lord bless you this Christmas season. We cherish our partnership with you and look forward to another exciting year of discovery in 2014.